Personally.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, pick it light. Picket signs, don't punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on. Everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us? Simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me. With brutality, come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Right, right on, right on.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. You're listening to Recovery Radio this morning. My greetings to you all. My name is James Boyd. I'll be your host. And joining me on the phone is Salim Pasha. Good morning, Salim.
Good morning, James.
Yeah, yeah. How you doing, brother? Sound like you're a little bit down.
Listen to Brother Marvin.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I would take it that you're kind of reminiscing a little bit, huh? Yeah, we're going
to
be talking about
all the way back to Vietnam. Bro.
Yeah, I know it. I know it, man. Some of the music that we used to listen to on those little transistor radios back then over in Nam. Our topic this morning, Salim, I think I sent it to you via text message.
You did, man. That's a very good topic. Man.
Yeah, yeah. The playground. And we'll go over some things.
Yeah.
I'm expecting a couple of other callers. But I do thank you for coming on the line, and I appreciate you sticking with me through this journey into the life of the playground community. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Salim, even though this is like your fourth segment that we're doing. I want to enlighten the people, those who are just coming around to Recovery Radio. Who are you and where you're from?
Well, originally, man, you know, I was born in Columbia, South Carolina. I came to Jersey 1963, 64. There's a place in Jersey that we used to call the Bottom. The Bottom. You know, the Bottom was just before you get into Jersey City.
Yeah, down neck.
Below Penn Station.
Yeah, down neck.
Yeah, what do you call it? The Neck and the Bottom. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. So we used to live next door to Jerry Lewis' uncle's tavern. His tavern was right on the corner. We used to live right next door to him. Mm-hmm. They used to see old Jerry come in there at times. I was young then.
Jerry Lewis?
He used to come visit Uncle. Huh?
The Jerry Lewis?
The Jerry Lewis used to come right there in Newark at their tavern right there on the corner where we used to live at, and down by Hayes Pool in Newark.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. That must be.
And then from there, we moved up to a place called Hidden Terrace. Mm-hmm. From Hidden Terrace, somebody set the house on fire. We moved to South 10th Street.
You say somebody set your house on fire at Hidden Terrace?
Yeah, somebody said that. No, it was like a boarding house, mm-hmm. and it was quite a few families that lived in there.
Oh.
So it was an argument. A man and his wife had an argument, and next thing we knew, the house was on fire.
Okay. And how old were you at that time, basically?
At that time, I think I was 9, 10, 11, just before I met you.
Yeah.
Before I met you at that playground.
Yeah, because because I was thinking, I met you, I had to be at 10, and you about 100 years older than I am, right?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. I got you by. No, I think you're older than me.
No, sir. We're not going to go there. you're the oldest of the group. So now tell me, you and I, we met on the playground. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what was going on when we met?
You know how we met? Huh. Remember when we was talking the other day, and remember those, you see the basketball player like LeBron James and them today, they be wearing them old black hats with the wide rim. Well, our hats was black, but we used to wear the little shorter brim. You remember we used to wear those little shorter brims?
The stingy brim.
Took them to the side.
Yeah.
And then from those, we went to cashmere hats. Uh-huh. Remember that?
Yeah,
we went to the Godfather hats, mm-hmm. and all of that other stuff. But it was before the Godfather was wearing those hats.
Yeah. Yeah, and that so and that was very stylish.
How we met, we were sitting there, we was in there playing ball, basketball. And that was just before we got into the game mentality. Mm-hmm. And we used to just play that ball right there in that on South 10th Street between Harlem and South 10th Street. Mm-hmm. We used to play basketball in there.
Yeah. So
you know what? I can say this on the radio, man?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you have to send me a memo. My engineer said, okay. John said, yes, you can say it. So go ahead.
I just wanted to tell you that Peggy is real sick.
Okay.
And I'll after the show, I'll text you her phone number.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, but anyway, we met at that playground. We used to play our ball there. We used to play kickball with the girls and everything. That's where we first met. And just remember how we got into the game?
So drug game, you mean, into the drugs?
No. It was a little before the drug game. Remember we was in the Roman Guards?
Yeah. Oh, you mean the gangs. I thought you meant the game. Your dialect is really changing, my brother, from Newark.
Yeah.
You're starting to sound like your South Carolinian self there a little bit.
Well, you know what?
Go ahead.
The thing about it, man, I'm reverting back to South Carolina.
Oh my goodness! So you're gonna, so I remember how you tell the story. Let's get back to that. I don't mean to take you off track, but that's what I want to talk about this morning. While we're putting together this manuscript called The Playground, talk about how the gangs started and what is the affiliation and how are they similar to the gang behavior today.
Okay, Now, you know, remember now, before we even joined the Roman Guards, we had started our own little game called the Rogues.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot about that.
Remember,
yeah.
We all had, as a matter of fact, man, we were some of the first ones that pierced ears. Remember, we pierced all, everybody had to have
that hole in my ear today.
To be in our game?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So how did you get your ear pierced? And come on, because we don't want to leave anything out. I want to know. Who pierced your ear? Because I don't think I was there for that. Or, no, I think we got it at the same time.
You know what? I don't
Martina Ford.
It could have been Sylvia, my girlfriend, or it could have been any one of them other girls. Because you know what they used to do is just put, you know, make the needle hot, put a little grease on your ear, and then push it through.
No, they put the ice on it first. Because she
I ain't put no ice on it.
Oh, well, you got a malpractice suit. They didn't use the ice.
Put some ice on it afterwards, you know, because it was burning. But other than that, that's how we used to pierce our ears.
Okay, so now we're trying to get into the gang. Go ahead.
Yeah, so from that, remember, all the girls was called Roguettes, and we was called the Rogues. And from that, it was a street called Huntington Street.
Yeah.
From Huntington Street, there was a big old gang down there called the Roman Guards.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there was what, about 300?
300 strong.
And there was about 300 strong. So in order to get into that game, you had to box. So they sent up their top fighters that day up in the playground. Remember me, you, Little Bobby, remember light-skinned Bobby?
Yeah.
And I boxed the leader of the gang at that time. You boxed old George. George boxed Bobby, and he knocked Bobby out. He knocked him out, but he knocked him down because he hit him with a good punch to the stomach. And then you and George box, and I box Bumpy, this guy named Bumpy. Then from that, we was in their game. Then they introduced us to their game because they had, you know, they was outnumbering us anyway. It was about 15 of us like that.
Yeah.
And
so
from game, when we joined them.
Uh-huh.
I think things were beginning to make some changes with us then, too, because then we started hanging out on Huntington Street. And
so the changes you're talking about is the decline of our behavior, or the escalation of the incorrigibility.
And that's when we met James Hester.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, he was the introducer to the drugs. He introduced me and Bookworm to those drugs.
Mm-hmm.
We, in turn, came back from off of Elizabeth Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Came back.
Shalane, would you mind being a little more specific for our listening audience? When you say those drugs, which drugs are you talking about? LSD, pot?
No, when we was using that heroin.
Uh-huh.
Okay, from when we was introduced to that, we came back, me and Bookworm, we came back up there to South 10th Street. Y'all was in the playground, me and Bookworm, we walked in, y'all asked us what was wrong, and we didn't even know what was wrong because we were nodding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, went into a state of nod. And that is when we really started using drugs, when we got connected to that other gang from those guys down there, because they were a little bit more advanced into what they were doing than we were.
Yeah,
we
and that was around what year? What year was that?
Playground school playing guys.
What year was that around?
65. Because it was doing, I know it was during the death of Malcolm that this happened in.
Yeah.
And it was just, remember, it was just, and it was, it was 65, because right after that, 2 years later, it was the 67 riot.
Mm-hmm. And then by 1968, we were off the streets, headed towards South Vietnam, right?
Well, 68, mm-hmm. I had joined the Marine Corps. Because mm-hmm. you remember, let's do this here. Remember, if you want to talk about this game first, mm-hmm. remember, just to make this real quick, remember when we was with the Roman guards, mm-hmm. we had another game called the Scarlet Fountains, mm-hmm. Sinking Sinners. We amounted to about, I think we came up to about 700 strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From that game, mm-hmm. from those two games and all of us combined together, we still could not beat those boys over there. They outnumbered us, but we all had fighters. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They was called the Aztecs.
The Aztecs.
Those boys was about 1,500 strong.
Yeah. So let's switch gears. Let's switch gears here a moment. I just got a text message, and I'm going to have another caller coming in. Her name is Shannon, and she's going to be calling us. I met Shannon a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to let her tell the story. But I want to kind of weave this other caller to bring us up to present day activities in terms of recovery, drug addiction, and the playground. We're going to see how they measure up and see what correlations we can find and see how we can improve on the status of people who are headed down that path on today. Is that okay with you, brother? That's good with you?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sure,
so
sure.
We're going to get back to the playground, and what we'll be doing in the coming weeks ahead is we're going to have a segment on the playground. And we're going to do that for 10 or 15 minutes. So, and because we want to get all the information out, we're going to talk about back then. We're going to talk about present day. And we're going to plan for some future behavior of those who are suffering with substance abuse issues. Okay? So now we were in the gang, and we got in the gangs, and then the escalation started. What were some of the memorable moments for you in terms of the gang behavior back in the 60s? What was something that you really remember that you can share with us that you recall? One of the things that stand out for me is when we were meeting with the Aztecs to do battle, I guess you would say, and how that was done. And I also would like to say, in getting into the gangs then, you didn't get jumped in. You got a fair fight all the time. Is that correct?
What are you talking about now when we met them and you saying memorable moments? I remember when our top fighters, because everything was about boxing. It wasn't about guns. It was always about boxing. Mm-hmm. Our top fighters used to meet them. If we didn't get into an all-out street fight, we used to meet, and all top fighters would have to fight.
Right.
And remember, they made me a warlord.
Yeah, they did. I remember that.
And so I had to box. Other people had to box. The leader of the gang had to box. The other second in command had to box. Everybody. And remember, we were the junior Roman guards.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. The junior Roman guards. Yeah. Uh-huh.
We were the junior Roman guards.
Yeah, I remember.
So everybody else, remember, we was not allowed over on Payshon Avenue.
Right. And so then the city was broken down into sections anyway. So everybody was, it was like tribalism going on. We didn't even have a word for it then, I guess. Not in my vocabulary.
It was sort of like the gangs today. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like the gangs today. But today, if you were in a gang, it was no such thing as that you couldn't wear a color. We didn't believe in that. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't no color. You just wasn't allowed on this side of the town if nobody didn't know you. If you knew somebody, you could go over there.
Yeah.
Somebody know us and they come over there, you're good.
Yeah. So Celine, so you think about what you just said about going to certain sides of a town. Growing up in the East and not down South, there were people, black people, during that same time, and I guess white people couldn't come on outside of town either in the South. people were really segregated then. And somewhere around there.
Well, that's good. That's good that you put it like that, because remember, in our neighborhood at one time, when we moved into that neighborhood, it was a bunch of Italians.
Right.
The Italians was dominating certain parts of North. Then, as time went on, they moved from out of North and went to Bloomfield.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then they
remember. Imperiali now, and all of those guys over there.
Mm-hmm. That was before Adonisio and Imperiali.
Adonisio, mm-hmm. Adonisio was the mayor.
Yeah.
Imperiali, he was cold-blooded mafia.
Mob type. So then you can make the connection because
no,
I heard
type, he was mafia.
He was
pure
mafia. Period.
He led the mafia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Imperiali at that time. He was our mayor.
Yeah.
So,
and
we
wasn't even allowed over there off of Bloomfield Avenue. Remember when we went to Abington, if you didn't catch that bus,
you might get murdered,
of Bloomfield Avenue, you was hurt.
Yeah. We had to run home, all the way home. So, Celine, now think about it. This is really, really good, man. The playground. So the playground was one of the only places that was a refuge for us. That was ours. After school, the teachers, the administration at South 10th Street School, which is now, Harriet Tubman School?
Yeah, it's Harriet Tubman now.
Yeah. They left Newark before it got dark, and that was our playground. That was our meeting place. And so the playground.
The only one that used to stay there at that playground around that area was Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown was a coach.
Heavyset Mr. Brown, not Mr. Rick.
Oh, Mr. Brown, that's right. He was a gym teacher, wasn't he?
Right. He was the gym teacher.
Mm-hmm.
At
South 10th Street School. Maybe I wonder if Mr. Brown is still alive. We're gonna have to try and find out.
You know what? No, Mr. Brown passed away some years ago, man. Mm-hmm. I found out that he passed away some years ago.
Okay, but
yeah.
Yeah, he kind of looked out for us there, in that area.
Yeah, well, the playground was truly our safe haven. Really, even before we even joined the games, everything, the playground was our safe haven. Before we started using the heroin, we was in that playground playing ball. We used to love to play kickball with them girls. We used to play dodgeball with them. You know, we used to do everything in the playground. Yeah. Everything was done in the playground.
Mm-hmm.
What
was the murder rate
really
around
let
there?
Let a person get hurt in a fight.
What was the black-on-black crime during that time? What was it like around there? Was it a lot of black-on-black crime, murder, robbery of each other? Was that happening in our playground?
In that playground, no.
That's
what I'm trying to say. See, the playground was not like that. The playground was not a place where you're going to come and fight. Even the gangs used to respect the playground, man, because everybody knew that the playground was like a
neutral zone,
a safe haven for everybody. It's a neutral place.
Yeah.
And everybody came to the playground. Uh-huh. Everybody.
Yeah. And so we would leave the playground after we joined the gangs and we traveled in packs because no one had cars to speak of, and we used to play some games as we walked from one neighborhood to the other. You want to talk about one of the games we used to play to amuse ourselves? Go ahead. Tell
you
that story.
You know what? The people don't understand. You know what? Remember, we used to play what they call punch box.
Okay, and what's
punch box is that it had a little metal plate in it. If you set one foot in that punch box and you didn't know you stepped in the foot in there, you would get hit by about six, seven pieces.
So when you say in there, so you just to be clear, when you say in there, what was on the metal plate was where? On the sidewalk, right? As we walked along.
Yeah, it's on the sidewalk.
Yeah, so we're going to have to end it right there. We're going to have to end it right there. I got another caller coming in, so let's kind of switch gears. I want you to stay on the line, okay? Good morning, caller. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. We're still with the playground. This is Raheem. I have somebody else calling in, Raheem. So we got two people plus myself. That's three on the line. So we start to lose signal. So when the phone rings again, I'm going to let that caller in, and one of you guys is going to have to hang up. Okay, and so Salim, since you've been on.
It's probably me, being that I'm at work.
Okay. So Raheem, we got you in there. We got you. Yeah, Salim is in. So we got some real good stuff that I'm going to send the link to you. But Raheem, thanks for calling in, man. And I guess if you can, call back probably 5 minutes to 10. Can you do that? Because I really want to bring this person on. You don't have to hang up just this second. There she is. Uh-huh. Raheem, I love you, brother. I'll talk to you soon. Oh, sorry. That's all right.
I just made a mistake. No. I just knocked Salim off.
That's
okay.
Right.
I hit the wrong button. Okay.
That's okay. All right. Hi, Shanna.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. I have another caller on the line with you, so he'll be hearing what you have to say.
He's not on the line. Okay.
It's just you and I, Shanna. It's just you and I. We had three people on the line, but I'm glad we kind of disconnected them. So I want to give you full rein right now, Shanna, because this is your first time on Recovery Radio, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, sure. Well, thank you for inviting me to call in. I am a recovering IV heroin addict. It's been a struggle, but I've been sober a few years now. I grew up in a upper middle class neighborhood, was part of the Just Say No Club back in the 80s, and I had some childhood trauma, and I guess when I was about 12 or 13, one of my sister's older friends was like, well, here, try this, and that was the first time I had ever smoked marijuana or drank, and within about 3 months, I was smoking pot every day and drinking alcohol.
Shanna, let me interrupt you there. Let me interrupt you there because I want our listening audience and the United States as a whole, because we have people listening to this broadcast once we send them the link all over the country. So I want them to get the full gist. So I don't want you to leave anything out. I want to know what year was this when you first tasted marijuana?
I would say in 1992.
Okay, what year was it that you first tasted an opioid?
Well, the opioids didn't come until later.
Okay, bring me up to speed. Go ahead.
That was probably when I was about 16. I had sinus surgery, and they had given me Percocet. And I remember I was so scared to take my pain medicine because I thought I was going to overdose on it. I would take like half, and I didn't want it. I just wanted to, you know, suffer through it because I had, here and there, had heard things about it, and I knew a couple of my siblings' friends were all excited about it. And at this point, I'm still, you know, I smoke pot, but I'm very anti any other drug. Yeah. I had my first daughter at 16, my second daughter at 18. Married their father when I was 18 and bought our own house. So we moved away from my parents, and I began drinking all the time. I had gotten into a car accident, I guess, in 1999 or 2000, and the ER doctor gave me Vicoprofen. And I have two small kids at the house, and I'm working a full-time job, and all I know is those Vicoprofen, when I took them, I had energy. I had the house clean. Dinner on the table was doing excellent at work. And, I mean, it just gave me that extra little kick that I felt that I needed. My daughter was diagnosed with a very rare and debilitating bone disease when she was a child. And it was very stressful, but the Vicoprofen just kind of helped me, you know, deal with that and get everything else done. And then the prescription ran out. So I just kept going back to the doctors. I was like, oh, I have these aches and pains. And I was a very small frame, and my children were both very big. And I started saying, you know, my hips were hurting. And they were like, oh, it's probably just because the kids were so big. Your back's a little out of whack, but here you go. And for about a good year, they just continued to hand me prescriptions for Vicoprofen without any actual, you know, x-rays or anything to back it up. Well, then I go in for my refill, and the one doctor was like, I think you'll be okay. Just take some ibuprofen. And I was upset, and I left. I didn't think anything of it. And, you know, I remember I was very antsy that night, and the next morning I woke up, and I was sweating, and my stomach hurt, and I was just having severe panic attacks. I couldn't figure out what was going on. And one of my friends at the time was like, here, you know, just take this, you'll feel better, and gave me an oxycodone. And sure enough, within 15 minutes, I felt better. So I started purchasing her medication from her, since the doctors weren't giving it to me. And then she was like, you should try snorting it. It hits you much faster. So then I started snorting them, and before I knew it, I was spending the mortgage on buying prescription pills so I wouldn't get sick.
Okay, so let's back up a minute, Shannon. I really like this. So you say before you knew it. How long was before you knew it? How long that before you knew it came
around? I would say about 4 months.
4 months. 4 months.
Wasn't a very long time at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And did this happen every day for 4 months before you knew it? Every day.
I was probably, it went from, you know, probably about 6 to 10 Vicoprofen a day.
And we're talking how much money?
Once I got on oxycodone and began to snort them, it started to, my tolerance was increasing, and I needed more and more just to get the effect that I was looking for. And when I didn't have it, I would get deathly ill with the sweats, the nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, anxiety, muscle aches.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. So let's pull back some layers. Let's pull back some layers, Shannon. So you say, from the time you first started, we're going to talk economics now. From the time you first started until you reached more and more, can you give me a dollar amount and compare the two? So we say, is that a good question? Is that a fair question?
It is. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So I was getting the prescriptions, which I think were about $10 a month. And then when I started buying them illegally, it started off maybe $30 a day, $20 a day, and within 4 months, it was up to $100 to $150
a day. $150 a day.
I had lost my job at that point, so we were just relying on my husband's income, and I was trying to hide all the bills and the foreclosure notices and the repossession notices and, you know, just paying one bill to keep them quiet, and I was a mess. I didn't know what to do, and I was spending all of the money trying to keep myself well at this point.
Yeah.
And
so just so our listening audience knows that $150 a day times 30 days is $4,500 a month.
Yes.
And so when you look at that $4,500 a month, you had to be knocking down some serious money. What year was this from the time you first started?
I believe 2001.
2001. $4,500. Now, you couldn't skip a day, right?
No, not at all. I'd be definitely ill.
Did you even entertain the thought of skipping a day? And when you tried, because I'm sure you did, because you had to run out of money.
Yes.
What would happen to cause you?
I called my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Mom, I need help. And I explained it to her, and I'll never forget that day. She came, she was like, okay, I'm coming over, I'm going to get the kids, because I was going to stay home and tough it out and just be sick. And I had told my daughters, I said, Grandma's going to come and take you. And they got all ready and dressed, and my mom's like, well, I have something to do, but, you know, we're going to go to the pool, and then I'll come back. And I'm like, who are you leaving them with? She's like, well, you're going to come. The water and sun will do you good. And I remember I just started crying. And I was like, well, okay, I need to run to the store. Can I borrow $50? And she gave me $50, and I had to go to my dealer's house and get pills so I could take my kids to the pool.
And at this point, your mother
didn't
know,
understand.
Right? Your mom didn't know? She was not aware?
She knew I was hooked and that I wanted to stay home so I could withdraw, but she didn't understand really what withdrawal was. Mm-hmm. She thought me going into the pool and swimming and being in the sun would help me feel better.
Yeah.
She had the best intentions, but had no idea what I was physically going through.
Yeah, and that is indicative of the community at large or the country at large. A large population thinks that you can just go lay out in the sun and take it easy. And maybe
get
eat a cone of ice cream.
And you're fine.
Exactly. Okay, so go ahead, Shannon. This is really good.
So shortly after this, about a couple days, I was talking to one of my friends, and she had a brilliant idea. She went down to a methadone clinic in D.C. and bought a prescription pad from somebody who was hanging around down there. She came over and she said, I found the solution to our problems. We'll just write our own prescriptions. I was like, that is genius. You know, and this is early, I guess, still 2001. She moves in, and we are filling 120 oxycodone a day and just going to all these different pharmacies. Mm-hmm. My grandfather passed away in September of 2001. And I remember he had asked me to take him to the doctors, but I was too busy trying to find a pharmacy that had pills. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. And the next day, my mom found him dead in his bed. So I felt horrible.
Okay. You felt like it was your fault?
During this time, I was helping plan the funeral. Mm-hmm. I couldn't take my friend to get our prescriptions filled. And my other friend was like, well, here, I just got back from the city. Try this. I was like, that's heroin. I'm not touching it. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you're sick. Just do a little bit. You'll feel better. And I was like, well, I don't want to snort it. My nose is already all messed up. He was like, well, I have a clean needle. Just sit down and I'll hit you and you'll be good all day. The little voice in my head said, don't do it. But I didn't feel good. I was so guilt-ridden about my grandfather. And I just wanted to feel better. I was like, fine. And I remember it didn't hit me at first. And I was like, it's not working. And I stood up and all of a sudden just my entire body got warm. I felt better. And it was the best feeling I had ever felt in my life. And I was like, oh, dear. Right then I knew I was in trouble. Mm-hmm. But, you know, mm-hmm. At this point, I'm already full-fledged addicted. So I had bought some dope off of him and a couple needles. I had no idea how to shoot up. Mm-hmm. I just tried to do what he had done. And I remember being so frustrated because I couldn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. We buried my grandfather and I'm at my mom's house and I get a call from my husband. And I was in the bathroom trying to find a vein, which I wasn't very good at first. And my husband calls and says, Shannon, you need to get home. I said, why? I said, my grandfather just died. We just put him in the ground. What is wrong with you? He was like, the FBI is at our door. I said, what? He was like, the FBI is at our door. Mm-hmm. I said, well, tell him, you know, what happened and that. I'm at my mom's house. I'll talk to him later. Mm-hmm. Well, they came to my mom's house and threw down a statement from one of the friends I was selling the prescriptions to, because we would fill the prescriptions, sell a few of them to pay for the prescription and use the rest ourselves. Made written statement saying that my friend and I were writing fraudulent prescriptions and selling them to him. And long story short, I got federal charges at the age of 22. This mm-hmm. was the beginning. No. They started investigating us September of 2001. I went before the judge in March of 2002 and was looking at 12 years for conspiracy to obtain and distribute 10,300 oxycodone pills. Mm-hmm. I'd never been in trouble before in my life. and I was scared to death. And my daughter was sick, and I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And it just, even knowing that I had 12 years hanging over my head, I couldn't stop using. And I was on pretrial, and I kept telling them, look, I need help. I can't stop. Mm-hmm. And my pretrial officer felt bad for me and tried to help me. And that was when I was first introduced to Suboxone at a Suboxone clinic. Mm-hmm. But the doctor kept just detoxing me. So I'd be on the Suboxone for a week or two, get off, be antsy, crazy. I had no idea about post-acute withdrawal or any of that. And I was always relapsing because I just wanted to feel normal. And I had no understanding of addiction whatsoever. I ended up getting the charges reduced to maintaining a drug-involved premises, which was still a felony, and got a year of house arrest because of my daughter's illness. Well, within, I guess, about 2 weeks of that, I was violated, and they put me in jail for 3 months. I was able to sober up, and I got out of jail saying, I'm never touching it again. You know, I'm free from this obsession and compulsion, and I'm never touching it again. My probation officer put me into a 3-month rehab treatment, inpatient, and it was a glorified 12-step meeting, mm-hmm. basically, that I had to live in for 3 months. Within 2 weeks of getting out, I was back on heroin almost on a daily basis. I'd met a lot of people there who, as soon as they got out, started using, and I wanted to, you know, see how my friends were and stand around a hot dog stand long enough, you're going to eat a hot dog. Mm-hmm, and that's basically right. What happened to me. I was, within 2 weeks, I was back to shooting heroin every few days. I managed to elude my probation officer for a while. Mm-hmm. And then my mother, I'm not really sure how I kept eluding my probation officer, but I guess he thought I was on the straight and narrow. And every time I was about to get violated, I would check myself into a detox. Mm-hmm. And so they'd think I would be doing good. By 2004, it was back to my house was about to be foreclosed on. We had no money. The car had been repossessed, and I was spending $300 a day, and I was stealing from my family. Mm-hmm. I was stealing from my mother. I would steal her checks and write them out and then just use the money to buy drugs. I would go to the grocery stores, get razors and oil of Olay, take them to the pawn shop to get money just to support my habit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my kids pretty much saw me do all of this. Because of the abuse I had as a child, I figured my kids were safer with me. Mm-hmm. So they would see their mom shooting heroin in the car. And on occasion, I remember one time I went to my dealer, and he was like, well, here, try this, and had given me crack cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I liked the way the two felt together. Mm-hmm. So then I started, on occasion, getting crack along with the heroin, and I would smoke crack in front of my children, and I would smoke in front of them, I would shoot up in front of them, and if I couldn't find a vein, I would yell at them because they were being too rambunctious in the car. Mm-hmm. And they were about 4 and 5 at the time. By 2005, I told my mom, I need help, and she called around, found a place in Pennsylvania, the Karen Foundation, sent me there. I was in rehab for 9 months. I did the 30-day inpatient, then they put me into extended for another 90 days, and then they put me into a halfway house for 5 months. I was scared to death to come home. I was just scared of seeing anybody I knew. And I was petrified. I came home, went to a 12-step meeting every day for the first year. I ended up getting pregnant with my daughter, who's 10 now, I guess in 2006. And she was, oh no, I guess it was 2007. Mm-hmm. I remember I was in AA every day while I was pregnant with her. Mm-hmm. I had the baby. and they gave it, had given me a Percocet. And my husband was very concerned. He's like, you don't need to take that. I'm like, look, I just had an 8.5-pound baby. I need something. Mm-hmm. Took the Percocet, and just that warmth came over me again. And I was like, it's okay. I'm not taking any home. Mm-hmm. I haven't opened a can of worms. Well, after I had my daughter, nobody from my meetings came to see me. So I started, between the hormones and what have you, I'd gotten to this poor, pitiful me. And I had a friend who was in the meetings who had recently gotten sober as well. He got diagnosed with stage 4 kidney cancer, mm-hmm. and he went out on a bender. And I went down to D.C. to try to find him. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to come back. And this person was very important to me. And I figured, okay, he's not going to be around me. He won't have anything to do. I'll use just this one time. It's not going to do anything. I've been clean long enough. And 3 days later, I was back to wanting it every day. And within a week, I was using every day again. And the whole cycle repeated again. I had just gotten off probation, so I had nobody to report to. My husband was like, you're using. I was like, no. This went on for a while, and then I went into detox again in 2010. Mm-hmm. Got out, and then the same people were there. And then my friend died finally from his cancer, and I went on a big bender then, went back into detox 2011. And, you know, it was just, I knew I needed help, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. In 2012, the beginning of 2012, I had had enough, and I went to a doctor who prescribed Suboxone. I said, I need help. You know, mm-hmm. I can't quit. They put me on the Suboxone, and then I felt like it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't take it. I would go get high, and then before I had to get my refill for the Suboxone, I would make myself detox, take the Suboxone so it was in my system, get the prescription, then go get high. In May of 2012, I got sick. I didn't know what was wrong with me. They rushed me to the hospital, found out I had a blood infection, and they kept me in the hospital for 2 weeks. Nobody asked if I was a drug user. I told them I was in a lot of pain, so they were giving me pain medicine. Mm-hmm. I get out of the hospital. I can't breathe. They readmitted me, said it was pneumonia because I'd been laying in bed for 2 weeks without moving. Mm-hmm. They discharged me a few days later. I go to my primary care. She said, something is wrong. She said, I want to get an echo of your heart, which is a picture of your heart. And I go there, and the guy's asking me if I'm short of breath. I'm like, yeah, they said I had pneumonia. He was like, okay, stay right here. Well, about 10 minutes passed. I got up to go to the bathroom, and I guess he'd come back. And they're like, where did she go? Do I need to call the police? Where is she? And I'm like, I'm in the bathroom. I said, what's wrong? They're like, you need surgery right away. I said, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. He's like, you have severe endocarditis. Your aortic valve is destroyed. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, can't they just give me antibiotics? They're like, no. So they transported.
Well, it's Selene.
Selene, are you there? We got you back on the air. I have another call.
Yeah.
Shannon, you still there?
Hello.
Is everybody still there?
Shannon, are you still there?
I don't know.
Hello? Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah.
Well, hold on, Selene.
Selene.
Yeah, Selene. Raheem. Yeah. I see what happened. Okay. Yeah. Well, we lost
Shannon, but she'll come
back. She'll have her call back. Okay, yeah.
But you know, I just want to thank you guys because we're getting ready to close the show out. Raheem, I want to give you the last couple of minutes. But Shannon is calling back. She was telling a really interesting story.
Are you back, Shannon?
I am back.
Okay, so hold on a second. We got three people on the line right now. Go ahead, James, organize it here.
I got it. Okay, Shannon, we want to hear from you for maybe another 1 or 2 minutes, and then I'm going to introduce you to my friends who are listening in. Okay, Shannon?
Okay.
And I think where
I
we
had
are.
My first open heart surgery 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I then went to pain clinics because I told them, you know, I had a bad disc in my back, but I couldn't get an MRI because I had a metal heart valve. No one expected me to be using. In 2016, The addiction continued, got worse, progressed. 2016, I'm laying in bed, January, and I told my daughter to call my husband. I was sick. In the 22 years we've been together, I never told him to come home from work because I was sick. They took me to the hospital, couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. After a week, found out I had MRSA, did another echo, and the top half of my heart had been digested. They take me to Fairfax for emergency surgery. I crashed. They told my husband during the surgery to prepare my kids I wasn't going to make it. Mm-hmm. I made it through the surgery, and when I got out of the surgery, I told the doctors, if you send me home, I'm dead. I had just reached the point where I was miserable with my life and didn't want to go on anymore.
Okay, Shannon.
They kept me in the hospital five months. I came home. The first year, I think I stayed sober strictly out of fear because they had told me if my pacemaker gets infected, I will die. They cannot do another open heart surgery. In April of last year, there was a series of unfortunate events. My valve failed by no fault of my own. They had to do another open heart surgery, but it was different this time. I was sober. I was healthy and was able to get through it. It hurt. I told them, do not give me any pain meds. I was the only person on the cardiac floor on Tylenol and ibuprofen. And then I realized, you know, fear is not going to keep me sober forever. I need to get active in the community and help other people. And that's where we're at today.
Okay, Shannon, I really appreciate that, but we're not done with you. And I want to invite you back just about all of the segments when you have time, because I know this is a stretch for everybody. Raheem is at work right now, and he's calling in. And Shannon, I'm going to get Raheem to say hello in just a minute, but let me tell you exactly who he is. He is the person that I started using heroin with, one of the people in my community, when I was 14 years old, 14 or 15. And so Raheem is, lifelong friends. And on the other side, we got Salim Pasha, who I met when I was probably 10 years old. His name was Jeffrey Coleman at the time. So it's a very interesting mix, Shannon. And I think that we really have something going here for this community, for that community, and for the United States at large, because we have a mix of the past, the present and the future in the recovery community. And we're highlighting the idea and the fact that recovery is possible. So go ahead, Salim. Salim, say hello to Shannon.
Yep, true that.
Salim, say
yeah. That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
Shannon, I want you to get used to those voices so you'll be able to tell which one is which, because we have a real opportunity.
All right, this is Raheem. Shannon, this is Raheem.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How nice to meet you.
Same here. You have a listening to you have a lot to share, and it could be helpful to a lot of people.
Yeah. We're gonna make sure.
I hope so.
Yeah. Not only does she have a lot to share, man,
she got a lot to be thankful for.
Well, yeah, amen.
That too, but it's an amazing story how what you went through.
And
going through that and not saying that you want to be on any pain medicine, that was a hell of a move.
It was awful. It was painful, but I was so scared. I didn't want to get back in that dragon's grip.
That was a very strong move. That was strength right there.
We're doing
the key that she just said. Right. She said that she did not want to get back.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
She did not want to slide back. That's the key, is what she did not want to do. And that is what people have to take from her story. Don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Fear kept me sober for a while, but fear doesn't keep people sober for very long.
And I knew if I didn't
do something to help this problem and show other people that I've been through hell and back and I've made it, you can make it too.
Yeah. And you know what we're going to do? Listen, group, listen to me. This is what the plan is. Raheem.
Fear kept me from going. Yeah, James.
Yeah, hold on a second. This is the plan, you guys, you three. We're going to do in the coming weeks. We're going to keep this going because we want to talk about the transition or the steps that you take to get into that dark hole. Because Shannon shared with me, and I'm sure you guys didn't hear it yet, but you'll hear it when I send the link, that she started writing prescriptions. Somebody got a prescription pad, and she started writing prescriptions. So we're going to open that conversation up on one of the upcoming shows, and then we're going to compare the all of our experiences with the judicial system, because as we said before, when Raheem got his time, and I'm going to say it, he passed out in the courtroom, Shannon. He fell out. You ever seen a man faint? Shannon.
Y'all ain't going to never let me live
He, hey, look, if you was y'all down here in West Virginia, wait, if you was in West Virginia and that happened, you make the front page of the paper.
This is a big, a long story behind that. They're my two brothers. They ain't gonna let me lay that down.
Yeah, but look, Shannon, this is such a bond.
I would tell people you were dehydrated.
Yeah,
yeah, you know, I had drank nothing, good, I had ate nothing, you know.
Hey, but Raheem and Celine
speaking all these numbers.
Yeah,
and the room started spinning.
and Raheem,
I thought those numbers he was talking about was time.
Okay, we're gonna have to wrap it up.
I thought he gave me 100 years.
Hey, we're gonna have to wrap it up, and I want you guys to start focusing on writing down some of the stuff that we're going to talk about before we go on air. Shannon and I have developed a relationship in the Recovery Academy. We're going through some training together to be recovery coaches, and I'll explain what that means to everybody, you know, in the upcoming. And so what I would encourage us all to do is just to think about what we're going to talk about, because what we say and the platform that we have can make a difference. And Shannon and I are hooked into this Recovery Academy, and I think it's one of the better things that is going on in terms of how we fight this and arrest this pestilence that's going on in the community by shining a light on. I am so happy that I'm able to come out of the shadows right now. How you feel about that, Shannon?
I love it.
Yeah. And so you know, I was talking to my engineer this morning. What if the conspiracy theories turn out to be true in the community? Because, Celine, we can open that up, because our lives changed back in, what, 19? When did we start, Celine?
64.
1964, 65? Shannon. And so the lot,
wow.
Yeah, our lives changed. But here's the thing. Here's the hit. The hit is that we're still here talking about it.
Amen.
And we're going to straighten it out. Everybody with me on that? Oh, I wanted to play a song. We're going to close with this song. And I want you guys to stay on and listen to it. Especially you, Shannon. You probably have never heard this song before, but I think it's going to amuse you. As soon as John,
I just
want
to tell Shannon,
go ahead,
that I am so pleased to meet her.
Yeah.
You as well.
Yeah. I'm going to get them here, Shannon.
Yeah. Call in today.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad. I'm pleased to meet you myself. I got the tail end of everything. But
this is just the beginning.
All right. Okay. Is this the time to start? Is it time to start?
Yeah, go ahead and start the song.
All right, it's The Last Poets, right? And it's, what's it? It's
Jones Coming Down on Me.
Jones Coming Down on Me. Okay.
Daybreaks. Oh, wow. I used to hate to hear that. Shakes. Nose running. Joint dripping. Mind slipping. Body aches. Jones coming down. Jones. Got an attitude. Jones fighting mad. Feeling bad. Funeral sad. Another 24-hour drag. Jones. Jim, I need me some scab. On my brother's do-rag. You caught me a transparent thin bag. Yeah. You see, cause I'm strung out on a white. She don't care, she's always
and that's enough to take my Gorilla Jones away. Now let me see what's happening on the corner today. Hey, there's my man, Brother Sweet Stuff Sam. Hey, Sam, can I get a play on a double tray so I can take off and lay? Okay, woman, get up out of bed. You heard what I said. I'ma tie the rope around my arm and heat the cooker. And I want you to get your ass out on the corner and play hooker.
And you have been listening to Recovery Radio. Okay, so we're going to have to wrap it up now. Go ahead, Shannon. I'm going to let Shannon have the last word. Is that always okay with? No, I don't need permission from you guys. Go ahead, Shannon.
That was an interesting song, but I think with this radio show, we can reach a lot of people and let them know that this disease does not discriminate against age, sex, race, gender. I mean, it affects us all, and we need to do something to help our community
heal. Is that right?
Very well spoke.
All right. Okay, Salim.
Very well.
I'm going to send you guys the link, and just be well. Love you all. Okay. Bye-bye.